I miss a green, for example, I'm already upset. When I find my ball in the bunker, I'm really upset. And when I find my ball in a
fried egg.
The dreaded fried egg.
Fried egg lie, I'm about ready to run off the golf course.
All right, we welcome on Ian Fillmore, an economist with a PhD in economics from the University of Chicago and assistant professor at Washington University in St. Louis. Ian, welcome on.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Ian, I got to say that you're a little bit different than our typical golf crazed guest, but you've done considerable research in sports and specifically tennis. You and Jonathan Hall wrote a paper that I've become just entranced with called Technological Change and Obsolete Skills, Evidence from Men's Professional Tennis. So I wanted to have you on just to kind of talk about your paper, and I think there's some really interesting parallels with it to golf and the current kind of state of the game that everybody talks about with kind of where technology is going with our game and how it's affected our game. So first off, tell us about, you know, how you stumbled onto this topic and wrote this paper with Jonathan.
Yeah, so I actually grew up playing tennis. As a kid, I got playing competitively, and I was played in the Missouri Valley area and played a little bit in college. And then my whole family was a tennis family, and my brother played as well and played in college. And so I kind of steeped in the tennis world and knew about that. And I ended up going to graduate school in economics and kind of wanted to write about what I knew. And I knew a little bit about tennis, of course. And so I said, well, I knew about, from talking to my dad and playing tennis growing up, he would often talk about playing with a wood racket, and he had some of his old wood rackets, and about how hard it was, and he would always say, like, yeah, you couldn't even hit the ball. You know, it took so much practice to just even make contact with the ball. He said the new rackets are so much better. And so I sort of knew that, right? The new rackets are better. But then as I got looking into it more, I realized it's not just that they made it easier to play, which they definitely made it easier to play, but they actually changed the way that people played the game. And if you go back and you can find a video of guys like Ken Rosewall or Rod Laver, and you can watch them play on kind of this grainy black and white video from the late 60s, and the pace of the game is so much slower. The players are moving slower. The amount of effort that they're exerting to hit the ball, it's just a lot more low-key sport. And and if you even look at the players look different. They were very slender. They weren't very muscular. They're often playing in long pants, you know, which is like difficult to imagine guys today doing any of this. And so I said, okay, well, I mean, something dramatic really happened here. And I remembered when I was a kid in the early 90s, which was right, we were finding right when this this transformation was really occurring. I remember everyone being really worried about how the game had gone from this beautiful game of tennis to this very crude and boring game where there was just sort of a serve and lots of aces and very short points, and people were kind of pining for the old days when there were these long and interesting points. And so then fast forward, I'm getting out of graduate school in around 2015, and I sort of occurs to me that, hey, we're sort of back, right? Like, you can go on YouTube and you can watch these points between guys like Nadal and Federer that are just like, they blow your mind, right? Like, the game, the point keeps going, and they're all over the court, and they're really entertaining to watch. And I said, well, you know, what's going on here? I got to looking into it, and it turns out that there was this transitory period when I was growing up where the game was shifting from the old wood rackets to the new composite rackets, but it took a while for that transition to work itself out. And if you actually, out of curiosity, I just looked it up and I said, okay, well, when were the records set for the youngest champions of each of the four Grand Slams? And it turns out they were all set at right around the same time. So Boris Becker and Stefan Edberg for Wimbledon and the Australian Open were in 1985. In 1989, Michael Chang was the youngest Grand Slam winner ever at the French. And then for the U.S. Open, it was Pete Sampras in 1990. So it was all within like 5 years that these all-time records for youngest Grand Slam champions were set. And I said, well, that can't be a coincidence, right? And so we started digging into it more, and it turns out it's not a coincidence.
So I guess this is the paper. So you've uncovered that there's not this coincidence. So you start to dig in and you look at the racket change, and so to give a reader that hasn't read your, you know, I think it's about 40-page paper.
Right.
What were your kind of, when you dove into this, what were the 3 or 4 things that you really wanted to examine?
So yes, the first thing was this idea that, so the idea that we had was a new technology arrives, and let's say the new technology is better than the old one. So it, in our case, it was a new tennis racket arrives, but it could be other things. It could be you're a farmer and suddenly tractors arrive, whatever it might be. So this new tennis racket makes all the tennis players better. So that's sort of the first effect, but that doesn't really do much. If everyone just sort of gets better, then, you know, on the tour, that's not necessarily going to benefit one player versus another. It's just everyone kind of gets better all at once. But then what happens is, at least our idea was, but the young players who haven't spent their whole life learning how to play with the old racket, they're going to have an advantage because they can tailor their game to the new rackets in a way that the older players can't. Like, they've already learned their technique. They hit the ball how they hit it, and they can't radically change their game overnight.
It's almost like that saying, you can't teach an old dog new tricks.
Yeah, I think that's, I mean, at some level that's right, especially when we're talking about people who are just at the pinnacle of human achievement, right? Like, just the smallest little thing makes a big difference for them. And so they've really honed their skills and optimized their game based on the equipment that they're playing with. Then you make a big change in the equipment, and all of a sudden the young players who haven't made all those investments in learning the old style equipment, they can start doing things that the old guys can't even imagine doing, right? So in tennis, all of a sudden people start hitting open stance, and they switch their grips from that continental or Eastern style grip to that semi-Western, and then even the extreme Western grip, which would have been crazy to do with the wooden rackets. It just wouldn't work. And so if you actually dig into the physics of tennis, I don't know how much your listeners want to know about the physics of tennis. There's a whole some great books written on this. But basically what happens is the string bed gets a little larger. It gives them a little more surface area to hit that ball with, and that little extra surface area allows him to get much more topspin and kind of swing up, and that extra topspin opens up the ability to hit with a lot more power than they were able to before, and so that starts to change the game in terms of the physicality of the game, the players involved, physical training, which wasn't so much a thing in the late 60s and early 70s, starts to become very important, and athleticism becomes much more important. Speed becomes very important, strength. So people first noticed it, I think, with that the serves started to get faster, mm-hmm. kind of like driving, I guess. Like, oh, yeah, the people are driving farther, right?
And the racket got the racket in tennis got bigger and more forgiving. Which allowed for more power, just like kind of it. to me, it's very similar to the driver, which became metal, got bigger and more forgiving.
Yeah, both more powerful and more forgiving. And because it's more forgiving, of course, you can take a bigger swing.
Yes, exactly. Right?
Mm-hmm. And so then that sort of increases the power that much more. Yeah, and then a very similar thing happened with the tennis rackets. So, but then once that happens, then people start to respond to that. And the whole game starts to adjust into what you see today, which is almost a very different game. Like I would be willing to bet that if you took Roger Federer back to the 60s, handed him a wooden racket and had him play Rod Laver, that he wouldn't do very well. On the other hand, if you took Rod Laver in his prime, you know, handed him a new racket and put him up against Roger Federer, it would be over in a minute. So like they're almost like different sports in a way as they've evolved over time.
Yeah, it's something you referenced also in the paper is like basketball with a 3-point line, where the original intention of the 3-point line was to give the big players more space. And in turn, you know, it led originally to more big players, but now it's led to the advent of the 3-point shooter, right?
Right, right. And yeah, so there, that was a paper that some other economists published a few years ago, looking at the effect of the 3-point line and finding that the primary effect of it was actually to increase the value of your center, right? Because the 3-point line moved the shooting guards out, opening up room for the center. So you can have these interesting effects that emerge that are a little bit difficult to predict.
Mm-hmm. So you start to see a change. So everybody gets better right off the bat. But then you start to see a change where younger players are getting better.
Right. And so one of the things we do is we looked at, so there are 4 Grand Slam tournaments every year. And we looked at what was the, because we just didn't want this to be a story about like one player, right? Or 2 players. Because most of the sports press, they like to focus on kind of that 1 or 2 players and those interesting anecdotes, which make for great reading. But we wanted this to be about, you know, bigger picture, what's happening to the whole tour. We said, okay, well, let's just look, simplest way to look at it is, if you want to think about a measure of success for players, advancing in Grand Slam tournaments is not a bad measure. So we said, okay, well, let's look at the average age of players who make it to the round of 16 in each of the Grand Slams. And we just sort of plotted that over time. And the figure is really striking. And what you see is the average age was around like 27 years old in the late 60s, early 70s. And then it just plummets to around 24 years old, with some of the majors being as low as around 22 years old during the late 80s and around 1990. And that was what people had observed at the time. And they had said, hey, look, you know, the game's gotten more physical. It's gotten faster. This is giving the advantage to younger, stronger, more athletic, faster players, right? And so all we're going to do is we're just going to make the game younger. But then what happened that I don't think anyone predicted is that it came back. And so now players are as old or older than they were in the 70s, back when the game was slower and less physical. And so there was really this temporary, there's this U-shape and this temporary period where younger players had this advantage over older players, but it was temporary. It went away after a while. And our explanation for this is that those younger players during that transition period, they kind of had a monopoly on knowing how to use these newfangled rackets that the older players were not sure what to do with.
Yeah, trying to learn how to adapt, the older player versus the younger player. So in reality, the generations that maybe you just got to the pro tour, you know, you've been on the pro tour for 10 years, and then the new racket technology, that generation got hurt. But then subsequently, every generation for a while after that also got damaged with the longevity of their career, right?
Yeah, so what you see is that sort of that Pete Sampras, Andre Agassi, Michael Chang generation got this boost from getting to compete against older players that didn't know how to compete with the rackets. But then the generation after them had no such advantage, right? And so I think there was this effect where because those that sort of 5 to 8 year window of players got to compete against people who didn't know how to play with these new rackets, they kind of got a leg up at the beginning of their careers, which you see in terms of kind of age of earliest Grand Slam winner and stuff like that. And so, you know, there's just the nature of the way the tour works. And I think it's like this in golf, getting that break earlier in your career is big, right? Because that allows you to be to qualify for more tournaments and things like this. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, which is something I'd like to look at in the future, is to kind of look at the effect of getting kind of an early break and how that plays out over the rest of your career. But certainly this generation had that.
It's interesting. So we're seeing this similar thing going on with golf right now, with like a youth explosion. And it's fascinating to see, you know, kids younger and younger are having more and more success. And it's like, you know, the first debuts on tour, like their debut rounds are all of a sudden in the 60s, where it used to be their 78s. But I think there's also this intimidation factor that's no longer, because they're seeing all their peers do really well.
Yeah, I would imagine so. I mean, I would just, it's one thing to be going up against a seasoned player and knowing that everyone else who's done it has gotten killed. Mm-hmm. And then it's another thing to be going up against that player and knowing that, you know, just a month ago, someone your age beat that guy.
Yeah.
Right. I think psychologically it's got to help, at least help you feel like I got a chance. I have a chance here, and to go for it. You're young, right? Go for it.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I guess you alluded to this a little earlier. During this period of massive change, what was the reaction of, say, the governing bodies of tennis, and then also, you know, the media, and the other, you know, big players in the space?
So the governing bodies of tennis took a while to really coalesce into a, so now we have the Association of Tennis Professionals, who's the overseeing body of this, of men's professional tennis. It was a little bit prior to 1968, there was a split between amateur tennis and professional tennis. And so in 1968, we had the beginning of what's called the open era, but that even took a few years to really sort itself out. And so once things kind of unified, that it was a very hands-off approach to equipment. So there's regulations about the height of the net and the size of the court, and that was kind of it. And as far as the rackets go, there was really anything you wanted to do was allowed at first. The first rackets that were widely used were these wooden rackets, and they ended up all being more or less the same size, not because they had to be, but because people quickly figured out that that was sort of the optimal size if you were going to make a racket out of wood that would work for a tennis racket. And that was the way all through the 70s. And then in 1976, Prince came out with the first larger head, and it was but the problem is the racket wasn't stiff enough for professional players, right? And so it was great for club players and beginning players, and it became very popular, but professional players needed something stiffer because of the pace that they were hitting the ball. So then a couple of years later, they came out with Prince came out with its pro racket. And it was only a couple years later that everyone on the tour had switched over.
So with that first racket, was the intention of that racket for the masses rather than the pros?
It was marketed at the masses. I don't know. It's hard to know if they knew ahead of time what they knew, right? But it was marketed at the lower level players, and I think some pros maybe tried it out, but it wasn't adequate. And so then they developed the pro racket specifically for the better players, because you know you can only go so far in marketing your racket to club and amateur players when TV all the professional players are playing with something else, right? And so you really want those racket endorsements, and so you know they quickly figured out how to redesign and engineer the racket so that they could have that larger string bed. And the way they did it was using what today are called, sometimes it's called graphite, although it's not actually graphite, but it's these composite materials that they figured out how to weave together to create a material that was much stiffer and would be able to have the stiffness the pros needed while still having that larger string bed. And once they figured out how to do that, then the other racket makers jumped right in, and you know it was a few years later, and wood rackets were a thing of the past.
So how did the technology continue to evolve all the way through today?
Yeah, absolutely. So there have been improvements in the type of string that players use. So even when I was growing up, the players were still using natural gut, which is made from what's called cat gut, but I think it's actually made from sheep's stomach, right? And it was very expensive. But the idea was that it gave the best feel. Nowadays, they've got a synthetic string that's better than that. So it's most of the players are using something synthetic. So there's been improvements in the strings that get used. There's been improvements in the rackets, even things like the grips. And so there's a lot of, as I said earlier, the physics of tennis are very involved. And so there's actually been a lot of research in the industry on really mapping out the physics of what happens in a stroke and how do you weight the racket, and you try to put more weight towards one end or the other, and all these sorts of things.
So like those would classify as like minor improvements though, and wouldn't have a massive effect like the racket.
Yeah, they're much more incremental and much more, I would say, idiosyncratic based on like different players. It would be much more customized. Mm-hmm. Whereas this change from wood to composite rackets was like it was better for everyone.
Okay, so it's like when there's a change that forces everybody to change, that you know.
Right.
And so as we kind of transition this to golf, and so in 1993 Callaway comes out with the Big Bertha, which is you know kind of the first metal driver that everybody you know is starting to look at, and then by 1997 it's pretty much fully adopted on tour, that everybody's using metal drivers across different brands, right? So one would say that would be a first technological shock, right?
Yeah, that's how I would describe it.
Mm-hmm. And then the drivers since have gotten bigger and bigger. You know, I think the original Big Bertha was 190 cc's, and then they capped it at 460 cc's. So
right.
You know, it's like almost three times the size. Not,
right.
Not quite three times, 2.5 times the size.
And I think, as I understand it, the constraint, like why didn't they just jump all the way there right to begin with, was they had to figure out how to make it forgiving enough that you wouldn't just hook it off the course. Is that?
I think so. I'm not sure. I think it was the aerodynamics too, of like being able to generate the same amount of speed with the bigger head. And then the light and how light it is. I think one of the big things was a composite head that eventually came about thanks to, I think like Callaway had this C4 driver. It was a complete piece of garbage. But what happened was then that composite head became like part of their next driver, which was really good.
I see.
So like, you know, like there was this evolution, but then with, so I think the thing with golf that happened that's unique is that we have this driver revolution going on.
Right.
And then in 2001, the ball industry gets completely turned on its head, where you have all these pros talking about, like, I'll never forget the day that I hit the Pro V1, which is when the ball went from a wound, you know, core to a solid core with a urethane cover, which, you know, all of a sudden provided less spin, longer shots, and, you know, much more consistency in the flight. So, you know, all of a sudden this ball was longer and straighter, significantly longer and straighter, that comes about in 2001. So it was almost like tennis, but where we have two massive innovations at once, both of which became universally adopted extremely quickly.
Right. So the and they complemented each other, mm-hmm. in that the, you know, the value of the ball is improved by having the drivers, but the drivers are also more valuable once you have a ball that can kind of, that you can hit straight at those long distances.
Yeah, exactly. So they would, the ball would curve less and everything. And then that ball continued to obviously evolve, and the driver continued to obviously evolve. And one fascinating thing is we've had this TrackMan come about, which is, you know, it monitors, you know, like when you swing and hit a shot, it gives you all these statistics on your club path, your spin rates, all these things, which has allowed the instructors to optimize their instruction to get people to hit it perfectly, right? So
right.
This TrackMan has become universally adopted as well on the tour as recently as the, you know, early 2010s.
Right. So yeah, as similar technology in tennis as Hawkeye, mm-hmm. that they so at all the majors and many of the lower level tournaments, they have these camera systems that are set up all around the court that can track the location of the ball through the whole match. And the most commonplace where you see that this used is when they challenge line calls, and they'll use the Hawkeye replay to say, okay, like, was it really in or out? But I don't know if everyone realizes this, but those cameras are going the whole time, actually. And so they can, you can compile all kinds of interesting statistics about how players are playing. It's not just tracking the location of the ball, but also its velocity and its spin. Right. And so you have a lot of data that you can dig into as a professional player now that simply wasn't available, 10 or 15 years ago.
So, yeah. So you could probably figure out how people are playing, how players' tendencies much easier than before, when you just have to sit and watch and observe and try and, you know, think about it. It's like, well, he hits this shot 42% of the time.
Exactly. So yep. That's whether it's serve tendencies, but also, you know, you even have information about where are they standing on the court. Are they way behind the baseline? Are they up, you know, and you can see all these things. It's kind of amazing. And I think that the sport is still at the very beginning stages of trying to figure out how to use all this new information. So this is true with everybody everywhere with big data, right? Is it's like, we've gotten really good at collecting and storing data, and we're still trying to figure out how to use it. And this is true in tennis, it's true in golf, and it seems to be true in lots of industries. So I think it's an exciting time to be someone who works with data. It's like, okay, a lot of cool things we can do with this, and we're just getting started.
So with golf, I think about 2005, 2006 is when we got to the 460cc driver head. Is that when you'd cap it? Like, since it's capped there, is that... How, if you were going to apply your study or your paper to golf, where would you say the transition period is, and, you know, when we would have started to see the effects? Because, you know, I have in my head where I think it would be, but, you know, I'm curious how you would go about it with knowing the general timeline that you know.
Yeah, so one thing about tennis that's different about golf is tennis player careers tend to be pretty short. So we find, like, the average career is like 6 to 8 years long, and a really long career might be 15 years, but that would be a long career. And so when you're thinking about the tennis context, from, say, the early 1980s when the rackets arrived to, say, the mid-2000s when it seemed like all the transition had kind of worked itself out and we're sort of back to a new, you know, we returned sort of back to equilibrium. So that's like 20, 25 years. That's almost like four generations of players, maybe three or four generations of players. So it took a while for everything to work itself out. So what's the typical career length for a golf player? I don't actually know.
I haven't ever found like an average. I've looked for this a bunch, but if I had to guess, I would say 10 years.
Okay, so it's a bit longer.
A little bit longer. So Phil Mickelson is now entering, he's 27 years. So on the long end, if you took the average, because there's so many guys that might be on the PGA Tour for a year and never get back, or 3 years, like, but if I think if you looked at the median, I think like, you know, 8 to 10 years, but then the long tail of the great players is really long.
Yeah, that's kind of how it is in tennis too. Is a lot of players in our data, you see them 1 year, mm-hmm. right? And then they just kind of don't make it. Or, you know, they kind of make it on barely, but then, you know, it doesn't quite work out for them for different reasons. It sounds to me like it was the combination of the drivers and the balls that kind of really changed the dynamics of the game from one where, and this was sort of my question. I know a little bit about golf, but not as much about, you know, as you and your listeners. As I understand it, as the driving distances have got longer, players have become less concerned with hitting the fairway, and they kind of realized that, you know, I'm better off going 50 yards longer, even if I land in the light rough or the rough, than I am laying up shorter and hitting the fairway. Is that correct?
Yes. Yeah. So it's, you know, like the proximity of the hole with somebody from 150 in the rough is better than the proximity of the hole if you're 200 yards away in the fairway.
Right.
So there's no reason not to hit the driver up there. And so I think
just go for it. Yeah.
The other aspect of it is the associated penalty of the rough. If you have a higher lofted club is much less than the associated penalty of rough. If you have a lower lofted club, you know, like a 5-iron versus a pitching wedge.
Right, right. So you get the, you know, the 9-iron or the wedge, and then if you can get within 100 yards or so, mm-hmm. then it's not a big deal.
Exactly. That associated penalty of being in the rough is much smaller the closer you get to the hole.
Right.
So I think
it's almost riskier to go for the shorter drive. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I think one of the interesting things with golf, though, also that happened is that there was this, you know, golf courses aren't all the same, aren't a uniform size, you know,
right.
like a tennis court, you know, you're playing on the same court. So golf courses have gotten significantly longer to attempt to combat this distance.
Right.
And what we saw was these longer courses actually played more into the long hitter's hand.
Right, exactly. Yeah, it's hard to know exactly what is the, so if you were trying to design a golf course that would help or that would give less of a benefit to long drivers, mm-hmm. Not quite clear what you would want to do. And maybe the right answer would be something like something about pin placement on the green as opposed to the length of the hole, mm-hmm. as you were just saying.
I had one of the top architects in the world on, and he said to challenge the long hitter, they want to make courses shorter and wider.
I see.
Because then it forces them to pick lines and, you know, they can hit drivers still, but you might get into weird positions where you can't hit a full shot in, and because of the spin, you know, you're coming into the green with less spin, so it's harder to hit it at certain pins, like you were talking about. So
right.
it's a fascinating thing. You know, in we're at the beginning, you know, just last year we had an 18-year-old earn his PGA Tour card. We have, you know, the top 10 in golf is now younger than the top 10 in tennis. First time ever that's happened. The average age of the official world golf rankings top 200 is 3 years younger than it was 20 years ago. So, you know, a significant change in the age of the sport. So to me, like reading your paper, it, you know, and this is my interpretation, but I'm curious, is like, we're just at the start of where it went from everybody got better, or, you know, everybody got better, some people were a little bit better, to now this young age is the age that grew up, never hit, you know, the small-headed driver. Because I'm 33, and I grew up with a small-headed driver.
Right. So now we've got the people who grew up with this, with these new drivers and these new balls, they never knew the old thing. They're not playing with an old style, playing old style game with new equipment. They're playing new style game with new equipment. And part of what that means is they can hit those drives really far. You know, what's interesting about golf that's different from tennis is in tennis, the court hasn't changed. They have changed some about the surfaces, it's really players playing against each other. Golf has an interesting dynamic where players are kind of playing against each other, but they're really playing against the course, right? And so there's a competition here almost between course designers and players, right? Which is an interesting dimension. What you were alluding to is, okay, well, in this arms race between course designers and players, okay, the players have made their move, right? Now they can hit these long drives. And now how are the course designers going to react to that? And then how are the players then going to respond to that? And so I would imagine, you know, if folks start to see the new courses that are designed to reduce the benefit to these long drives, you probably would see innovations in things like the irons, right? Where we've focused so much attention on how do we make these drivers hit farther? Well, maybe now it's more about, well, how do we come up with better wedges and better, like 5 irons and things like this that will allow you to maneuver through those holes? I don't know, but I think it'll be fascinating. I can tell you what happened in tennis. So the first thing that people figured out how to do with the new rackets is they figured out how to serve really hard. And that kind of outpaced everyone's ability to return those serves. And so there was a period where there was a lot of hard serving and a lot of just aces and very, very short points. And people were complaining that the game had gotten very boring on the men's side. But eventually, players figured out how to return those serves, because even though the rackets allowed you to serve hard, the rackets also, with that larger string bed, gave you more room for error to return that same serve. And so players started to figure out how to return those serves. And it turns out if you hit the serve very hard, it makes it almost impossible to serve and volley. And so whereas in the past you'd had these serve and volley players who would serve and then rush the net, and that would end the points quickly, as the serves got harder and harder, actually that strategy no longer worked. And so the serve and volley players started to become a dying breed, and more players, they were serving those hard serves but staying at the baseline. Players were getting better and better at returning those serves, and then the points started getting longer. So it's hard to know when these new equipment changes occur and something immediately changes in the game. It's hard to know if that's going to be a permanent change or if it's just a transition period to something new.
Interesting. So you know, it almost is like the market normalizing. is the whole idea of it. Is there's, you know, the technological shock, massive change, youth comes in, but then it's just, it takes a while for it to normalize, and you get a game that's wildly different, but has the same types of careers and the same, you know, the ability to have a longevity, a long time great player is back.
Right. Mm-hmm. And there's a few different players here. So there's the players themselves, there's people designing the course, and then there's the racket, or the, in your case, the club makers and the ball makers, right? And those club makers are responding to what the players want, right? And what the players want depends on the courses that they're facing, right? So everyone's kind of responding to each other. And as these things evolve over time, it's always interesting to see where they go. And it's very difficult, I think, to predict. I don't think anyone would have predicted in 1990 where tennis would be today in terms of the style and how it's played and everything.
So if you were given advice to golf, you know, I might be one of the people that's like, this is crazy. What's going on? What would you say?
Man, well, that's a great question. I would say, I would be cautious about making big changes that are difficult to undo. So making
like a rollback.
Yeah. Changes that are trying to take us back in time, because mm-hmm. it's really hard to put the genie back in the bottle with a lot of this stuff. And rather than trying to say, come up with some new rule that, you know, that say, oh, it has to be a wound ball, no more solid core balls or something like this, right? Rather than doing that sort of a thing, you know, allow the designers of the courses, allow the equipment makers, you know, allow the players to experiment and find new things. And I think that the course designers and people running the tour, like, they want the game to be entertaining. They want it to be interesting. And they're going to find creative ways to adapt to these new technologies that retain kind of what everyone loves about golf without having to kind of put the sport in a straitjacket and try to keep it in, you know, static rather than allowing it to evolve over time.
Yeah. So, because if you did a rollback, for example, and you went back to say the small heads, it would just cause the same effect that happened when you went to the big heads.
Sure. Yeah. That would be really interesting for like a follow-up study for us, but I don't know if it would be good for golf.
That's the one thing I've always, you know, I've been in this camp. I thought about is like the biggest problem is like, so one of our issues with golf is like, you know, you could imagine if baseball allowed aluminum bats that all of a sudden Wrigley Field and Fenway Park would be irrelevant. So the most historic golf courses are being forced to lengthen and do all these crazy things that cost, you know, the expense of building a golf course is very high. It's not
right.
not a cheap thing to do. Is that the keeping up with the distance has become unsustainable. So that's mm-hmm. that's the added issue as opposed to a tennis court that remains the same size regardless.
Right. And that's where, yeah, I you know, I don't design golf courses, so I don't know the details on how you do this, but I imagine that designers are going to come up with more creative ways than just lengthening holes, but more creative ways. Maybe the dog legs start to look different, or there's more dog leg holes. Things that keep the course interesting without allowing the sort of these drivers to make it too easy or something like that.
So here's something that just popped in my head is like, if we had done nothing to the golf courses, by continuing to change them, are you creating like an effect that is almost magnifying the technological change?
Well, I think every time the courses change, you're going to see club makers and ball makers change in response, right? So whatever you change about the courses to make them challenging in a new way or whatever, the equipment makers are going to be trying to come up with ways to help players overcome those obstacles. And players are going to want to buy the equipment that works, that does that. So, yeah, I think it's going to be – there's always a flux in these things. And you see this, I think, in tennis. You see it in golf. You see it in other sports as well, where the equipment keeps evolving. And then the sport kind of has to keep up with it in one way or another. And as you change things about the sport, there's this feedback loop where, you know, players are going to respond. I think if the sport doesn't ever change anything, we'd expect scores to just continue to fall, right? Because equipment's going to keep getting better, players are going to keep getting better, and they're going to get really, really good at playing the courses that never change.
Yeah, and that's I think that's one of the golf's issues is everybody's stuck on this par aspect, like score to par, but it's like, you know, it's they shot 20 under. It's like, well, it's a completely different game than 20 years ago. Like, shouldn't hold right. on to the same par. You know, you can change the number that par is. Like, change it from 70 to 67, and all of a sudden they were only, you know, instead of 20 under, they were 8 under.
The one technology that you mentioned that I thought was really interesting were these green reading books.
Oh yeah.
That I thought was very interesting because that – so when we were thinking about these rackets, we were thinking about changes that affect that increase the returns to one type of skill and decrease the returns to another type of skill. Mm-hmm. And so the creation of these technologies that will kind of read the green for you really reduce the returns to being able to read a green. Well, at the same time, we've increased the returns to being, you know, driving distance or something like this, right? Mm-hmm. And so that was, I thought, really fascinating. And I don't know what that's going to do to the game, but
that's a fascinating thing that might be a more chewable study to look into because we have shot link data before and after. These right. screen reading books. And I would be really interested to see if that might be one of the biggest, you know, where older players, like you learn how to, you know, you're constantly learning how to read a green better and better and better. You know, right. there is a diminishing return when you get older, your putting skills typically fade. But all of a sudden, these young kids have a book that tells them how a green breaks that these other guys have played for 15 years and that advantage is extremely minimized.
Right.
In a way.
Right. And so, yeah, in the past, it had been the case that being able to read a green was something that took years and years to really develop and hone. Mm-hmm. And now it just doesn't anymore. Right. That's something that I would have thought would be a big benefit to the younger players relative to the older players.
Yeah. And the older players, like, they don't even, like, really know how to, you know, it takes time to learn how to read those books versus the kids that grow up with them now.
Right. And it's just, it's kind of second nature. Kind of like my kids and the iPad. Mm-hmm. They, I don't know how they know to just swipe left, but they know.
So, when I was reading you referenced computers, that's, like, the perfect example of this is, like, where... I'm 33. My parents are not nearly as good with computers as I am. And I'm not nearly as good as the generation younger than me with computers.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, imagine it's, 1980 and you've got a secretary who's been a secretary for the last 25 years and, you know, is very, a very good typist and, you know, uses the typewriter all the time. And, you know, you remove the typewriter and you install a computer, you know, one of those green screen computers at the time, and you say, "Here's this thing. Use this now." What's her response going to be, or his response going to be? It's going to be, "Well, it looks like I got a typewriter that I don't have to use whiteout on, right? Like, which is better?" And so that secretary would say, "Well, this is definitely an improvement," and the productivity would go up. But treating a computer as if it's a typewriter that doesn't require whiteout is kind of like, you know, what happened with these older players when the new rackets arrived. Like, it was a better version of what we had before, but it's very hard for them to fully realize and fully take advantage of the fact that, no, this isn't just better than before. This is something fundamentally new, and to work through all the implications of that.
That's a great parallel. I think the computer one with that really explains a lot of stuff with both tennis and with golf, with how the different generations, you know, are able to use the modern technology.
Yeah, and so the question for golf will be: are there more large equipment innovations to come in the future, or have the big ones happened and it'll be mostly incremental from here on out? So in the case of tennis, there was that big one and then incremental, you know, from then on out. And so you kind of got this return to what we'd had before. If there are more ones on the horizon, then, you know, it could take that would prolong how long it's going to take to get back to equilibrium.
It seems like, you know, at this point, the governing by the USGA and RNA are like much more stringent about like, no, like this is not going. Like they limited what a green book could have this last year, which made everybody really upset. You know, they've started to do different things where they talk about de-skilling the game, you know? So I would guess that we're at the end of, I don't think we'll see any major innovation. Like, I think stuff like TrackMan will probably still continue to evolve, but we aren't going to see any like huge ball or driver technology advances, in my opinion, because they're pretty capped out.
Yeah, and the issue is always, so what happened with one of the things that happened in tennis, so I told you it was very hands-off, people can do what they want, And then someone invented what's called spaghetti stringing. So in spaghetti stringing, what you do is the normal way that you string a tennis racket is just a basic weave pattern. So kind of alternating under over, and you weave the strings together. In spaghetti stringing, you do it in this crazy way, right? Where And the effect of spaghetti stringing is that it makes the spin that gets imparted to the ball unpredictable, right? And so you'd hit this ball and it would have some crazy spin on it and it was almost impossible to return. And so then at that point they stepped in and said, no, we're going to outlaw spaghetti stringing. Mm-hmm. And so at some point the governing bodies did say, okay, this type of an innovation is kind of destroying the essence of the game, or is contrary to the essence of the game. And the determination was, if even the person hitting the ball can't predict the spin they're putting on it, like that's not what we're going for, right? And similarly with golf, if there's a consensus that being able to read a green with a naked eye is an important aspect of what it means to play the game of golf, then I could see why you would be opposed to the books. But
yeah, and I think with tennis, what you saw was the game went one way, and I think with golf we're like, it's very like, drive it as far as you can, wedge it, you know, where, you know, wherever it go, it driving it straight and far is obviously most important, but driving it far is more important than driving it straight. So
yeah,
and then it's wedges and putter, right? But eventually that's going to come back and normalize in the next 2 to 4 generations and become more a complete game, right?
Yeah, and it might take the form of increasing the penalty of those roughs or something. Mm-hmm. And maybe you make the grass higher in the rough. Or I don't know what they'll come up with. And I don't know what the rules are limiting the way that courses can be designed. And maybe those need to be rethought as well, mm-hmm. to give the course designers more flexibility in creating courses that are still challenging and interesting, even in the face of the new equipment that's come out.
It was fascinating. They had one of the leading architects put a center line bunker. So he put a bunker in the center of the fairway.
Oh, okay.
On a hole that was a regular PGA Tour stop, and the players hated it because it was like, you know, right where they wanted to hit and right in the middle of their shot distribution, right? So,
right.
You know, you put a cone on how the shots distribute. So, like, they didn't know where to aim, but it favored if you played up the left side into this 30-yard window, you were, like, greatly rewarded, and that's where almost all the birdies came on that week.
I see.
But the players hated it so much they asked for it to be removed. It got removed this year.
Yeah.
So there's this other dynamic of the players, if they complain, the architects can't actually, like, that's an example of an innovation that tests that player, you know, changes the look of everything, and the players complain and it gets removed.
Yep. And yeah, so that'll be the decision, I guess, the governing body folks have to make, is how do we trade off? We want the players to be able to showcase their skills, because that's what people want to see, right? They want to see people playing golf at peak levels of human performance. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, if the course is too easy, you actually can't. Yeah. Right. It's not impressive to watch professional players play on a course that's not hard enough.
And it doesn't create the true best player. Right.
You right.
Know, it'll lead to less variance in scoring, and, you know, it won't identify the true champion. You'll have a packed leaderboard and a bunch of guys really close together, and you're not really sure who the best player was that week.
That's right. And so, what I imagine will happen, what'll have to happen is some consensus is going to have to emerge about what types of frustrating things are considered appropriate. Like bunkers are always frustrating.
Yeah.
Like all players would like all the bunkers to go away. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. You don't want to land in one. And so but everyone gets like, oh, we're used to seeing bunkers in these sorts of locations. We're not used to seeing them in this one. That throws us for a loop. But, you know, when if the culture of the game changes and people say, well, actually, like, the ability to maneuver around a mid fairway bunker is that's like a real sign of technical prowess. Mm-hmm. Then, you know, I imagine that the players would view that as a necessary challenge, as opposed to an irritating.
Yeah, because that's a test that identifies the best player, the one that's able to maneuver, who has the most confidence to aim to one side of it and hit it around it.
You can say the same thing about, you know, water hazards or whatever. If you weren't used to them being there and suddenly someone put a big lake between you and the green,
yeah,
you would say, like, what is this? But, you know, we're used to that stuff. And so
what's also fascinating is the period, the rise of professional golf came during the period of the dark ages of golf architecture, when it completely departed from, like, the ideals of great golf, which, you know, is the most timeless golf courses embody these different. And now we're in a period of architecture that's starting to embrace the, you know, principles that, you know, made golf more popular than any sport, you know, or than it had ever been, not any sport, but than it had ever been. So it's a fascinating thing. So, you know, in a sense, like, the future of the game, a lot of it is architecture.
Yeah, I think my optimistic side says that this renaissance in equipment, golf equipment, will lead to a renaissance in course architecture, mm-hmm. and a renaissance in player strategy.
Yeah. As
players facing kind of new, these new course designs, armed with new equipment, start coming up with more creative and innovative ways to play the game, which is exactly what you see in tennis, right? And now, you know, I would say that the game is as entertaining as it's ever been to watch. And, you know, if you ever get to watch a professional tennis match in person as opposed to on TV, it's mesmerizing. Right? It really is amazing to watch them hit the ball.
U.S. Open Wimbledon is definitely on my bucket list, one of those two. Hopefully yeah. both.
Yep, Flushing Meadows or Wimbledon. Yeah, they'll both be great.
Hey, Ian, thanks so much for your time. I will put a link to your paper, you and Jonathan Hall's paper, which was Technological Change and Obsolete Skills, Evidence from Men's Professional Tennis, so everybody can kind of read it. And then, I don't know, you on social media anywhere? Can people, you know, read your thoughts on the economy?
I have a website, and my co-author has a website.
Okay.
For my own psychological well-being, I steer clear of Twitter and social media. But
what's the website?
Let me just pull it up here. Good question. So it's just a Google site, sites.google.com/IanFillmore, I believe.
All right, I'll put that link in there. But thanks so much for your time. I think this I hope people find this really interesting, and as interesting as I find it.
Well, I had a great time, and I learned a lot about golf as well. So thanks for having me on.
Yep, thanks, Ian.